सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। Water is in the air these days. Everybody in the world is a water expert. Everybody is writing all kinds of things on water. So I thought we should take up the subject of water. I invited my good friend Rafe Alam, who has carved out a career in water, seems to be a good water lawyer, environmental lawyer, knows his water stuff. So let's try and pick on Rafe's brains. Rafe, do we have a water crisis?
Nadeem uncle, assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me on the podcast, finally. We've had, in my opinion, I think we've had a water crisis for several years. This is not anything new. This is not something that sprung out of the woodwork all of a sudden. We did a survey for Chatham House in 2014, where we surveyed water experts throughout Pakistan in collaboration with groups that were doing the same thing in Afghanistan, Nepal, India and Bangladesh and Pakistan, asking them about what water opinions were. And in Pakistan, we spoke to several hundred people. But what was interesting is there were only two issues that absolutely everyone had consensus on. Because if you ask 200 people something on water, you get 1,000 different answers. But there were two things that they unanimously agreed on. The first was that we are in a water crisis.
And no, this is 2014?
Yeah, 14. Okay. And the second one, interestingly, was that there is absolutely no role for women in water infrastructure or policy throughout Pakistan. It is a silent, it is absolute.
So when you say we've got a water crisis, okay, women I can understand.
We'll get to that.
But tell me, when you say water crisis, what do you mean? We still have floods. We still have rivers overflowing.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we gave away three rivers. So we'll talk about that too. But first, what is the water crisis?
That is a great question. What is the Pakistani water crisis? Mm-hmm. You know, I wake up to Facebook texts telling me that the water crisis would be resolved if I turn my faucet off while I brush my teeth. Meanwhile, there's droughts in part of Pakistan, and I scratch my head and I say, well, that can't possibly be the solution. Mm-hmm. So what is the water crisis? I think the interesting thing about understanding any water issue like the Pakistani water crisis is conceptual. Mm. Water is a tricky subject to get your head around because, like the substance itself, it takes the form of whatever vessel you put it in. Mm. So if we talk about water and climate change, it's very different from water and agriculture. Mm. It's very different from drinking water. Mm. It's very different from the water required to, you know, make the crop of cotton necessary for my t-shirt. Mm. These are all different scales of water, and there's a crisis brewing in every single one that's distinct and different. So there's no single water crisis, I would say. There are multiple crises following on all sorts of levels.
But let me ask you a simple question. An economist like me, for example, I could simply say, hey, let's price the water. So what's wrong with that? If I price the water, it'll rationalize its use and everything will be fine?
There's no silver bullet to these problems. I think water pricing is necessary in several sectors. There's absolute ration for that. There's also a need to have a water discourse that asserts what citizens' rights are to water. You know, how much water, what quality of water. I think those discussions need to be had along with the discussion of how expensive water should be. So it's not a silver bullet. There are lots of, you know, issues.
So
that
are you telling me we're going to run out of water?
Yes.
Will people like me not be able to get water to drink and bathe in my daily necessities?
Well, we're living in Lahore right now. Uh-huh. And what you're talking about is domestic water consumption.
Okay.
The city of Lahore is unique in the developing world in that people like you and I have 24-hour water on tap. It is a unique phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You leave Lahore or you go to any other city in the developing world, you will not get 24-hour water. There is a shortage in places. Mm-hmm. There's a shortage in Islamabad, there's a shortage in Faisalabad, mm-hmm. there's a shortage in Karachi. Mm-hmm. So what that means is, no, you can't have your shower. Mm-hmm. You can't have your shower unless you're rich enough to buy water that's brought to you. Mm-hmm. The concept of having water as a service delivery evaporates. Mm-hmm. That's one concept of running out of water. Mm-hmm. That's not because necessarily the amount of water has finished. Mm. There's a lot of structural issues in providing water to citizens. It could be that your housing society is so far away from the main lines that you don't have water. Mm. It could be that you don't have enough electricity to pump water from the ground for your shower. Mm. So there could be reasons why there isn't water. But yes, in Lahore, you don't have a problem right now. Mm. But in other cities, this problem exists.
So now explain to me. What they're saying is we're running out of water for many reasons. But the most important that everybody, including the Chief Justice, seems to have coalesced on is
the dam.
We didn't build the big dam, and we should have built one big dam every 5 years.
Well,
do you agree with that?
Well, firstly, I think that the question is incorrect. I think anyone asking whether the dam should be built or not is asking the wrong question. I think it's important to recognize where the water is consumed. I mean, just by way of contextualizing this, most of the water that exists in Pakistan, that's from glacial melt or in the ground or that comes during the monsoon, most of that water is used in agriculture. So somehow or the other, it finds itself in rivers or in the canal systems and in the distribution systems of the irrigation network. 90%, it's said, of the water resource of Pakistan is consumed by agriculture. And about 5-odd% is consumed by the domestic sector, and another 5-odd% or so consumed by the industry.
Really?
Something
those
like
are
that.
The ratios.
Those are roughly the ratios. People would say industry might be a little less.
Might be a little bit more or less. Yeah.
But most of the water, you have to understand, is used in agriculture. So when we say that Pakistan is running out of water, we're running out of water for agriculture, we're running out of water for the domestic sector, and we're going to be running out of water for industry, broadly speaking.
Okay.
In agriculture, running out of water means that the monsoon is erratic. It's not providing the same amount of water at the same time. It means that glacial melts are in excess, and those glaciers will wipe out in the next 100, 150 years. And that there's a lot of water theft. Half of the water in the irrigation network, in the canal system, is lost. Straight up, about 40% of it is lost due to unlined canals or straight up theft. So you have to ask yourself, if half of the water in agriculture is being stolen, it's kind of like the energy sector.
Yeah.
You know, do you build another plant or do you go for conservation of efficiency?
Fair point. But tell me, in agriculture now, the way I look at it, are we using appropriate technologies in agriculture? Because I'm told that we overuse the water in agriculture.
I believe so. Now, here I have to give my exceptions. I am an environmental lawyer. I'm not a farmer. I'm very much a city boy. But I'm told that our agriculture system was set up by the British over 150 years ago. And it was meant to distribute large amounts of water to an area that had no scarcity. And that's how the system is built. It's not built on rights. It's built on a system of allocations. And we're still using that sort of infrastructure to irrigate our lands and to provide us. That's perhaps not the best way to go about doing it. The inundation or flooding type of agriculture that we practice might not be necessary now. There are better techniques, absolutely.
But face it, technology then was flood irrigation.
Yep.
And technology then was, hey, there's abundance, use it much as you like. But now technology has changed. There's drip irrigation, there's all kinds of other ways of doing things. In fact, people are using very little water to grow crops. Can't we learn?
I'm sure we can.
And then we are growing sugarcane.
Now we're coming into the pricing area. Because when farmers do use water for irrigation, the abeyana in Punjab is very low. It's less than 100 rupees to get an acre foot of water. And that's, you know, about the price of a kilo of sugar. That has to be rationalized. I should also point out that not all the water in agriculture and farming comes from the canal system. Because many of the canals are unlined, the canal irrigation network has led to a charge in the aquifers, a lot of areas coming what are known as salinity and becoming waterlogged. So a lot of water in agriculture is used up by sucking it up from the ground with tube wells. And there's been this old SCARP program in the 1960s that was meant to combat salinity, basically replaced the canal system with tube wells. We've got now more than 1 million tube wells in Punjab that are sucking up from the aquifer. This aquifer is, you know, maybe recharged, maybe a confined aquifer, but a lot of the water that we use in agriculture comes from the ground as well. So, and that's a pricing issue as well, because if you have a tube well, you get a subsidized water tariff for agriculture, and you can use water as much as you want.
What about the aquifers? I keep hearing that the aquifers are also getting, they're not getting replenished, and they're drying up, etc., and you have to dig deeper and deeper. Is that correct?
In Lahore, for instance, yes. But I'll qualify that by saying that there's been very little study of the aquifers in Pakistan. I know the irrigation department has some studies of the aquifers, but there's, we still need to know how the Indus Basin aquifer works. Where is it connected to other areas and so on and so forth. But anyway, coming to Lahore, yes, in Lahore we hear that the aquifers drop down to several hundred feet. It's because the fact that, for instance, the time of partition, Lahore had a population population of about 800,000 people. Now it has a population of 10 million people. Mm-hmm. And most of the water that Lahore consumes comes from tube wells from the ground and is thrown into the Ravi. But since the Indus Water Treaty, the water of the Ravi has been diverted to India and is used by India. And so there's no replenishing of the Ravi aquifer on the Rachna Duab that we live on. So as a result, the water table is falling. But if you go to... So we're in the Bari Duab. If you go to the Rachna Duab, which is just north between the Ravi and the Chenab where Sialkot is, Shekhupura is, the aquifer there is recharged by the northern Chenab River, so they don't have a groundwater problem. Lahore does. So we need to have a study of what the aquifers are like to be able to have any sort of sensible policy about what to do with water pricing or domestic water pricing. Yeah.
So let's look at it. We've got, what are our water sources? Our water sources are the river from the glacial melt or whatever, that is it. And then whatever seeps through into the aquifer, those are the two main water sources.
It's either in the sky as a cloud, it's on the ground, or it's underwater.
Or it's underwater.
And it's a closed system. We've had the same amount of water on Earth since the Earth coalesced. And it's the same amount of water we'll have on the system. What we're doing with this limited resource is that we're also fast polluting it. We're rendering the fresh water that's available unusable for a variety of reasons.
So now, give me the solutions. Do we build the big dams or do we not? What is the cost of building the big dams? And I presume each one of them will take 10 or 15 years to build, and they're extremely expensive, and the gains will come over a long period of time. After that, can we recharge the aquifers? Is it expensive? Is it as expensive as the dams? Is it not? Thirdly, is it a conservation issue? What is the issue?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand water at all, so please explain.
I scarcely understand it myself. As far as the question of dams, again, is concerned, I sort of liken it to a dam is a piece of infrastructure. It's water infrastructure. It's kind of like saying the jail road signal free will solve the problems of traffic in Lahore. You know, it solves some problems, it creates some problems. So it's an infrastructure issue. You put up a huge dam, it's going to have some benefits, it's going to have maybe a lot of disadvantages. What a storage dam like Kalabagh does is it allows Pakistan to store water to be used at a time when it doesn't have water. Right now, we're told we have 19 days of storage. And a whole bunch of water passing through the Indus system and winding up in the Arabian Sea that's not harnessed or stored that could be used for other purposes. And the idea behind Kalabagh Dam is to increase the water storage for Pakistan so that we have more water to use during the dry periods. And that's why we won't need to have Kalabagh. The side benefit of something like Kalabagh is the electricity it will produce. So that's another added argument for the dam, is that it will produce so many megawatts of electricity. And the cost of it, I'm not an economist or I haven't seen the feasibilities of it, but I'm told it's in the billions of dollars. And I imagine it would take over a decade to build.
Easy. Now, there is a choice. Should we build Kalabagh or Bhasha? Should we build both? Or are there other choices?
Are there alternative energy investments that we could make that could, you know, perhaps... These are questions... For policymakers.
So, now, these questions are all, I agree with you, they're complex questions, but they're all very important questions. For example, I think energy is a different issue. Let's leave that out for the moment. For water, do we need Kalabagh and Bhasha both, or can we do without them? Can we recharge the aquifers as a substitute? Or can we build some other smaller dams to be able to do the same thing? Or,
You know... Are there alternatives?
Yeah.
I was speaking to Simi Kamal last night, talking about just this, and again the dam as well. And she pointed out that, you know, we raised the level of Tarbela. Tarbela's on the Indus.
Yeah.
And Tarbela still runs dry.
Right.
That means the water behind the Tarbela, the river behind the Tarbela, is still not enough to fill up the dam. And Kalabagh is upstream of Tarbela. So what water are you going to be harnessing?
Very interesting. Very interesting.
I heard from the... Director General of the Met Department at Staff College some months ago, that the last 10 odd years, the trajectory of the monsoon as it comes barreling through past India up the Arabian Sea and into Pakistan has been erratic and is moving southward, which means that the major catchment areas for the monsoon rain are going to be south of the Kalabagh dam site. That's perhaps another option to take into consideration.
Very interesting.
You know?
And besides, Kalabagh is a political issue. Let's face it, it's a political. So what's the politics behind
that? You know, as a lawyer, I want to answer that, actually. Because in my opinion, one of the issues that rises when you talk about Kalabagh Dam, one of the responses you get is that other provinces or federating units have not agreed to it. So there seems to be a dispute in the federation when it comes to the construction of an infrastructure project. And I find that interesting because we've got only one provision in the constitution that actually speaks about water. It's Article 160. It talks about the distribution of hydropower benefits. It says that the benefit, the profits of any hydroelectric station will be given to the province in which that station is situated. And the net hydel profits will be calculated according to a formula that will be approved by the Council of Common Interests. 2 points here. The province in which the powerhouse is located, not the storage. Kalabagh, the powerhouse will be in Punjab, the storage is in KP. KP won't get any net hydel profits out of the Kalabagh Dam. This formula itself is also problematic because it was set by a bureaucrat, A.G. Nkazi. It's called the A.G. Nkazi formula and approved by the Council of Common Interests in the early 1990s as part of that unbundling of the power sector in Wabda. But that's like 20 odd years old and it needs a revision because the energy mix of Pakistan has shifted. In the early 90s, we had far more hydel energy in our energy mix than we have today. And so that profit sharing formula needs to be revised as well. So what I'm talking about is that there needs to be a deal in the constitution that speaks to the other federating units whenever a dam is being built. Other provinces need to be shown that there are benefits that will accrue, both financial, non-financial, tangible, non-tangible, that will be shared in an equitable manner amongst the provinces. Mm-hmm. You know, if you guarantee that some of the profits of the electricity will go to rehabilitate the communities that have been displaced, for example, might do fantastically well in the land acquisition process, which has been one of the notorious delays in all the hydel power projects that we've had in Pakistan. So I think, you know, when it comes to the construction of any dam, one of the issues it does raise is how the federating units share the profits of something as expensive and as potentially beneficial as something like a dam as well.
But water is a common right, right? All four provinces have the right to water, and we have the IRSA, whatever, the sharing arrangement. So in that sense, when you build Kalabagh, apparently Sindh is upset that their water will be stopped. They won't get water. Sindh already says that building of Tarbela has meant that Indus has kind of dried up in estuary, and that the sea has come into the estuary. Is that correct or not? And also the KP says that their prime land will be flooded.
No, it will be. So, I mean, these provinces need to be assured and they need to be made part of the benefits of the dam. If they're financial benefits, sure, give them. If they're concessions to be given out for construction, well, give them out equitably amongst the provinces. You know, between KP and the Federation, there is a dispute still, till today, as to how much the Wabda owes KP for the construction and use of dams on the Indus.
Yeah.
You know, it's still an issue that our Federation has not been able to resolve.
Because apparently in that famous sharing formula, the hydel profit sharing Kazi formula, apparently the cost of the dams is not fully taken into account or something, right?
Well, yes, it isn't. Kazi Saab seemed to think that when calculating the cost of electricity produced by a hydroelectric dam, you exclude the cost of constructing the dam because it's actually a storage infrastructure. So the cost is for a storage infrastructure and then you're just calculating on operating costs. And I think it was Faisal Naqvi who once raised the analogy. It's like saying that my Mercedes is the cheapest car to run in Lahore, excluding the fact that it's 2 crores to call. You know, it's kind of like silly like that.
That's right. That's
so that formula needs to be looked at again.
Now tell me, what about recharging the aquifers? Is that a solution? Is that, sorry, first of all, technically a possibility? Is it expensive? I mean, what's it?
What my little knowledge of the aquifers is, again, it comes back to the fact that there's so little knowledge we have of them that it's difficult to say. I don't know how you'd go about recharging an aquifer. We've polluted a fair amount of it with the pesticides that we have and then throwing all of our sort of industrial and domestic waste into riverbeds that then seep into the aquifer. So we've polluted a vast amount of it, and I hope that there's a potential of recharging the aquifers. And if that's the case, then that would be great to hear, but I don't think I have the technical expertise on this.
Now tell me, what about the agriculture? We've decided that using a large part of the water, but yes, there could be some savings there.
Yeah, this is a question I want to ask you. So according to these sort of figures that are thrown around, that, what is it, 90% of the water in Pakistan is used for irrigation. And then we're told that, you know, most of Pakistan still lives in rural areas, though you and I will dispute that. And that in rural areas, hal bura, everyone is under the poverty line. So I want to rephrase these statistics to say that, all right, we were given, by the grace of God, the benefit of the Indus Basin as a resource. And currently we take most of that water to take a majority of our people and keep them under the poverty line. Surely there's a better way to use this water. You know, if you take an acre foot of water and use it to the manufacture of silicone chips, you're going to employ tens of thousands of people and make a lot more money.
Very good point.
If you take a limited amount of water and use it in a water fountain in a hotel, it's probably the most profitable use
of
water.
That's true.
Do we have to use this agricultural form of extracting the resources of the Indus Basin to keep a majority of our people under poverty? I think we've got to rephrase that entire equation.
Very good way to look at it. Very good way. Great way to rephrase the narrative. But look, let's put it this way, just carrying that step forward. I think you're absolutely right. I think we overplay and romanticize agriculture. We still seem to live in the 18th century where we think that agriculture is the panacea and will look after the whole population. Whereas technically and everything, the narrative has changed. And we really have
Of the tens of millions of 20-year-olds in Pakistan where they would rather work.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? And they are showing themselves by their migration patterns. We can see that. But look, what about the industry and the household sector? Are we using water optimally there, or is there waste?
Well, here, actually, I want to start by saying that I'm extremely distrustful of these figures of how much water in Pakistan is used by industry and by domestic. Let's just assume for fighting's sake right now that it's 5%, 5%. Mm-hmm. It could be whatever.
Yeah.
But these are two competing sectors because a lot of industry is located where populations are. So there's a competition between domestic use and industrial use. Industrial use is devastating because it's incredibly polluting. And very few of the industries in our cities have any remedial sort of measures in place to treat the effluent before they discharge it into water bodies or into the aquifer or into drains or into nalas and into the public realm. So it's a highly sort of, it's a resource that's being competed after and it's being polluted very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few groundwater laws in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
The groundwater law in Pakistan that we have is from the Easements Act. Angrezon ka Easements Act of 1870 kuch, which is a property law. It's a property law that talks about your rights on other people's properties, and that's upper riparian, lower riparian comes from there. And Section 7 of the Easements Act says that if you own land, you own everything underneath it, including any water that is not in a moving state. Very interesting phraseology. Firstly, I want to say that this rule came to us by the case law developed in England at the time, the common law. And the common law at that time in the 19th century was the result of the industrialization period when water for agriculture was being used up by water for industry.
Mm-hmm.
All these people setting up mills in Manchester and using water and diverting it from the rich landlords who used to have it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a huge fight in the British courts and in the House of Lords about who owns water, kiska haq hai. And this was the sort of formulation that came to Pakistan from the UK. Duck. If you own water, you own everything underneath it, all water underneath it that's stationary. There's an academic in SOAS, Philippe Coulet, who says that this is absolutely ridiculous because England is so small and there are entire deserts in India that are larger than the UK. And are you telling me that only people who own property have a right to drinking water? Ye kanoon aapne unka liya hai, wahan to barish padti hai. Agar pani ki kami wahan barish padti hai, yahan to barish hi nahi hai. Aur humne wo kanoon utha ke le liya.
Fascinating.
Acha, angrezon ka bhi jo kanoon hai, this moving water is a Roman concept. The Romans, for Romans, stationary water was a private property. Moving water in aqueducts was a public property.
Of course.
So we have elements of Roman law determining our groundwater law in Pakistan right now. Now, iska result ye hai. Let me just say that if you are a water bottling factory,
yeah.
I went to a water bottling factory in Shekhupura and they told me proudly that they would extract 220 million liters of water from the Rachna aquifer, put it into these indestructibly polluting plastic bottles and sell them to us at 15 rupees plus sales tax. You know, it's unbelievable. I asked them, what concession do you give the local government or provincial government to use this? And the answer is nothing. They pay nothing but the electricity cost to run the tube well that they extract the water from. And the environmental pollution from those people should be in jail for what they're doing.
So tell me, how would you rewrite this law?
You'd rewrite it with people in mind.
What are the principles?
Okay, we have, thankfully, some very powerful principles, legal principles, that have been evolved by the courts. Qazi Faiz Issa in 2005 was the judge in the Nestle and Sindh Institute of Urology and Transplantology case. Nestle tried to set up a bottling plant in Karachi. And SIUT went up against them and said, what are you doing? This is an aquifer. It's a public property. And that's what the High Court upheld. And this principle has been upheld by the Supreme Court, that all natural resources in Pakistan are held in a public trust. And they have to be consumed in a way that benefits Pakistanis and not for any private or commercial interest.
Pakistanis in general. Pakistanis, not one person.
And this principle was the principle behind Rico Dick. This principle was behind the mini golf case. This is the only environmental principle that has actually stopped projects in Pakistan. It's a very robust principle, and it's been used multiple times in different contexts. And I think that's where we start from. Agar aapne ye pani nikalna hai, you do it for the benefit of Pakistan. The folks that I met in Sheikhupura also, for some reason, gave me their annual statement. And I read that they made something close to 90 billion rupees after tax in 2016. And I say, what if 10% of that were to be taxed by the local government and used for schools and infrastructure?
Change the world.
It would change the bloody world.
Yeah.
You do another 5% for the environmental pollution that they do for the bottles there. You have a completely... So you start with that principle and we can sort of rewrite the law.
Fascinating, fascinating. Okay, so now tell me, what you told me just now tells me that water, and I suspect it should have occurred to me before, water being the source of life is an incredibly complex ecosystem that we should be studying very carefully. Tell me, is there any research institute, any place in Pakistan where we are studying water?
There are thankfully a few. We have at the HEC level the Center for Excellence in the Study for Water at Mehran University.
Okay.
At LUMS here in Lahore, we have the Water Informatics Technology Center.
Okay.
That's across sectoral. Mm-hmm. And the Hisar Foundation has set up the University Water Network and has signed an MOU with NED University to set up a water research center over there as well. So it's all relative infancy, but these are important institutional steps. I know that Mehran University has now started passing out students with expertise in water. WIT offers these week-long courses twice a year on a cross-section of water issues.
What is WIT, sir?
The LUMS program.
Okay.
So they take about 150 people in each class. They have classes on sociology, on hydrology, on the engineering, and on law. And it's a week-long course. Okay. I think it's fascinating.
Very good.
Yeah. And let's see, the Hisar Foundation Network is also active. They've got a think tank. I'm part of it, I have to confess. I'm very proud to be part of it as well. And there's a small network of people that we are trying to move out of the... We're trying to get... Listen, I'm back to the...
Right.
Most of the so-called experts of water in Pakistan are UET graduates.
Okay.
They're... Mashallah, very senior, and to a man, they're a man. So a lot of times you're getting these very old men policymakers. We need younger people in the water policy world. We need more women in the water policy world.
Okay.
And so organizations like WIT and Hisar are very well gender balanced.
Okay. Good input. I fully agree with you, but let me ask you a question. Given the enormity of the problem, I would argue, correct me if I'm wrong, that we should have probably a high-powered Water Commission as a standing body of the government.
Why?
With all these guys. Why? Funded to do the research. No, my point is to elevate the discussion. Don't you agree?
I have another issue here. Our tendency to believe a national policy will solve things. I want to give you a problem that I'm facing with understanding water and water management and water law, and it comes from our constitution.
Okay.
As an issue for governance, water is a provincial issue.
Mm-hmm.
It has always been a provincial issue. It was only made a federal issue with the establishment of WABDA and then subsequently with the establishment of IRSA. And you also have the Federal Flood Commission. These are the three federal organizations on water. Everything else is provincial. I mean, drinking water is not a federal level subject. You know, water and sanitation, you know, diarrhea is not a federal subject. So under our system of governance, the federal government can only make, or the federation can only make laws that are in the federal list.
Okay.
Water is not in the list. The Council of Common Interests makes and sets policies on subjects that are in part 2 of the federal legislative list. उसमें पानी नहीं है. तो अभी ये जो वाटर पॉलिसी इन्होंने निकाली है, पॉलिसीज आर पास बाय द कैबिनेट. द फेडरल कैबिनेट हैज नॉट सीन दिस पॉलिसी. This policy was not placed before any provincial cabinet. It was not discussed in any provincial assembly, neither by resolution or
so
otherwise.
What is
the democratic mandate of this policy? Where does the federation, I ask you, get off giving us a federal policy when it's not in its constitutional mandate?
Who made this policy and how was it made?
Someone in the Planning Commission made it. It was made for a variety of reasons, and I think one of them was political, to show that we had one. And it contains absolutely everything, like all of the policies in Pakistan do.
Give me the key principles.
There are 23 things in it. इसमें ये करेंगे, drips लगाएंगे, drip irrigation करेंगे, कालाबाग dam, नहीं कालाबाग का नाम नहीं, the dams बनाएंगे, हम water की pricing करेंगे, हम वो water को meter करेंगे, हम फलाना करेंगे, हम irrigation को lines, वो canals को lining कर देंगे. It contains everything, a multitude. It has a paragraph, it has a section on water law. It's three paragraphs, nine lines long. Sirf. So it's one of those policies that makes, to my mind, no sense.
When was it passed, if you say cabinet?
Council of Common Interest.
Council of Common Interest, agreed. Okay.
So but I question the democratic mandate behind this document.
Fair point. I agree with you. I am not saying that we should have a national water policy. That's a separate matter. I'm saying somewhere we should upgrade the research on the project.
Absolutely.
Right now I'm interested in, because I think a huge amount of discussion is taking place with a lot of emotion, including the Chief Justice telling it's a Zaz to be the water expert, which is kind of bizarre. It's Zaz, a lovely guy, you and I both know him. Very educated, but certainly not a water expert.
Even wrote the Indus Saga.
Exactly. A lovely book. But my point is very simple. We need serious water research somewhere, and I agree with you, it should not be any one group, either male, female, old generation, young generation. I would argue we need the only reason I'm saying water commission or something is to give it profile.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need under it a bunch of think tanks. Mm-hmm. I would get the whole university system to start working on water. I would put in maybe 100, 200, 300 water researchers, from economists to sociologists to water specialists to engineers to everybody, because water is a complex subject. I want every discipline to talk about it, and I want a big debate on the subject so we learn from it. Because I suspect, now Rafi, I'm older than you, and I remember I was a baby when a boy when Indus Waters Treaty was done, but quite frankly we swallowed it wholesale, and I want to discuss that with you next. But I also want to tell you, I have not seen a coherent discussion on water ever.
Yeah.
Sporadically, now and again, it comes up.
Yeah.
But we never really get into the issues, aquifers,
I can, perhaps rivers, the most clearest whatever. Answer I can give you for that, other than the Indus Treaty, which I do want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear in our constitution. The Council of Common Interests sets policies. It also, the second thing it does, it only does two things. It sets policies on those subjects in part two of the federal list, and it will hear complaints from the provinces regarding natural water resources.
Mm-hmm.
If the council cannot resolve the dispute itself, it may request the president of Pakistan to establish a commission to look into this. It's written in black and white in the constitution. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, the Indus Water Accord came as the result of the Haleem Commission. Chief Justice Haleem was appointed by the president of Pakistan to look into the dispute of how the provinces would resolve the distribution of the waters of the Indus Basin amongst themselves. The result of that commission was the Indus Water Accord and IRSA as a federal law approved by the Council of Common Interests to federally regulate. So there is a way to do this. It's written in our constitution. This is where people say our politicians and stakeholders have let us down.
Yeah.
This is where when there is a clear-cut, unambiguous road for you right there, and it's not taken, it's a missed opportunity.
So tell me, Indus Waters Treaty.
Yeah.
Let's take it up. Was it a mistake?
If you consider partition a mistake, because it's a direct result of some English lawyer coming and putting an arbitrary political line through one of the largest irrigation networks on the face of the earth, and not bothering to ask what the rights of upper and lower riparians would be. So in some ways, the Indus Treaty is the other side of the coin of the award, the Radcliffe Award.
Was there no other way of resolving it other than giving up?
The way I hear...
Do you see any other country...
It's Indus story time.
Riparian rights?
Indus story
Please
time.
Please tell me.
All right. So there was a standby arrangement between India and Pakistan that lasted 6 months that sort of related to the division of assets. And after 6 months, when the standby agreement came to an end, the Indians turned the headworks at Madhupur off. Madhupur is just now on the other side of the border after partition, and it's the headworks of the Ravi area, the command area here in the Bari Doab. And that meant that in the 1st of April, 1948, which is sowing season, there was no water. And that's where the dispute starts. It started there. What Pakistan found itself in was in the late 1940s and early 1950s, in a global sort of securitized United States Cold War, just early Cold War era, with the United States very concerned that India's non-aligned status would lead to South Asia becoming a sort of North Korea, South Korea type of situation. So they were very keen ke ye na ho idhar, and they sent various delegations to woo Pakistan. There was a lot of cultural influence and so on. And they sent, amongst other people, the president of the Tennessee Valley Authority. This is the Hoover Dam wala. And the Hoover Dam is a great success where they turned the deserts of California into these green fields and brought prosperity to the West. And this fellow comes and has a look at this remarkable sort of Doab system, this abundance of water, a network of canals that the British have built us, and goes, this is unbelievable. You've got all the glaciers in the world. All you need is a good, coordinated, integrated system, and these two countries will do remarkably well. His was a coordinated, integrated approach. And he wrote an article in Collier's magazine when he got back. It's a 3 or 4 pager, which was then picked up and read by the president of the newly formulated World Bank. The bank was looking for clients. So the bank made a proposition to India and Pakistan. Okay, we can harness this potential for you if you can resolve your dispute on water. And so that's how the bank got involved. The negotiations on the treaty went through the 1950s. Didn't seem to be going anywhere until all of a sudden Ayub Khan shows up. One unit, good friendship with the United States, and within a year and a half, the Indus Treaty is signed off. Where the next decade of development is no joke, because there were several $100 million that came from the Indus Basin Development Fund that helped finance the Tarbela and the Mangla and a bunch of other irrigation replacement infrastructure. Where do you think the decade of development came from? It came from the benefit, the bounty that this treaty had reaped. But the treaty is interesting. It wound up not being an integrated and shared network. It wound up being the only water treaty, transboundary water treaty in the world, that divides the resource rather than shares it.
Exactly.
Like the Danube River flows through a bunch of European countries, they all share the water.
The Nile flows through so many countries.
They share the water. Yeah. What we've done here is, and I think that was one of the difficulties in negotiating with India and Pakistan, is that at one point the deal was just, all right, you guys take three rivers and you guys take three rivers. You know, the three eastern rivers of the Indus Basin, the three big tributaries, Bias, Ravi and Sutlej, go to India, and the waters of the three western rivers, the Indus itself and the Jhelum and Chenab, would come to Pakistan. And the words of the treaty are, for the western rivers, India will let flow the waters. That is their obligation, to let flow. They can't stop the water. They can use it, sure, they can use it for hydropower, you can have run-of-the-river dams, you can use it for domestic purposes.
No, but apparently it says they can use 20% of the water.
Not, it doesn't say 20% at all. It says that the maximum pondage of any run-of-the-river mill will be 3 million acre-feet. That's it. So they're not storage dams by any stretch of the imagination, but India is obligated to let flow. And that's where the dispute starts. But, you know, going back to this, I wonder, because my father, your good friend, Asad Alam, rest in peace, used to tell me of the times when, after the Indians turned the Madhupur network off, Pakistan responded by building the BRB canal, the Bhambawala Ravi Bedia link canal that brought water from the Jhelum under the Ravi and to the Sutlej, so that this would not happen again. And during the construction of the BRB, Dad recounts that he was taken from school to dig in this canal, because this canal was important. Pakistan was a young country. It needed to stand up on its feet. It needed to be independent of India. And it also needed to defend itself from India. And so several things happen here in the history of Pakistan, the nascent nation. The idea of water infrastructure is infused with nationhood. It's also infused with security. The two themes that you see echoed even today, when you question something like the Kala Bagh Dam, you're called a traitor. Where does that apprehension come from? I think there is deep down in the hypothalamus region of our brain this connection that somehow the other water security and nationhood and defense are the same thing. Just a theory.
No, but tell me, no, that's a fascinating point, but tell me. I mean, when we gave up our rights and when we signed the Indus Waters Treaty, Do you know, from our side, what the research and the thinking was? Did we actually do any research thinking? Because I understand the Indians actually have done some research and thinking on this. Did we just sign the deal without any?
Dr. Undala Alam, who's done her PhD on the negotiation of the Indus Treaty. And I'm ashamed to say I have not read her thesis yet. But I'm sure that that would be part of it. Like I said, I think part of the answer comes from the fact that the treaty started, or the idea of the treaty started, as an integrated network. And it wound up being something very, very different.
Which makes sense. So where did it change?
There might have been all sorts of political situations at foot. Now, another thing I want to point out here is the fact that the treaty was signed by not only a military dictator, but also during the one unit period. That meant there were no provinces in the western part of Pakistan that were talking about the treaty. It was just the western part of Pakistan signing with India. Just before partition, if we just wind back the clock a bit, there had been disputes between the states of Punjab, the pre-partition states of Punjab and Sindh. During the late 1800s and early 1900s, as both of these states independently constructed irrigation infrastructure, independently, because water is a provincial or state subject, always has been. So Punjab had started developing first, then Sindh started developing on the Indus, and as Punjab started developing more irrigation, especially in South Punjab, it put a stress on the water available to the Sindhi. So the Sindh-Punjab dispute was a pre-partition water dispute that was resolved in 1945. And essentially the dispute said, or the resolution said, that the waters of the Indus would be used exclusively by Sindh, and the waters of the tributaries of the Indus, the Bias, Chenab, Ravi, what have you, will be used by Punjab for its irrigation infrastructure. That's roughly what the agreement said. And if you look at the Indus Treaty, it's vastly different. The Indus Treaty gives three of the eastern rivers, to India. And those rivers are then, those empty riverbeds are now fed with water replaced from the Indus. That's a direct sort of contradiction of the Sindh-Punjab agreement. So the Indus Treaty has this sort of sub-national conflict tied into it. And it's something I don't think that can be resolved. There are other issues in the treaty as well. It doesn't look at climate change. It was signed before the environmental movement took off, so it doesn't really look at how water and glaciers will be impacted.
But tell me, since we signed the Indus Waters Treaty, have we actually understood what it does and tried to manage it? Or is India managing it better? I get the sense that India has invested more in terms of understanding the treaty and using it, and we have not done that well, which is why we are losing at the World Bank now.
Agreed. I've had the pleasure of knowing some people who worked at the Indus Water at the Pakistan Indus Commission, and the situation there is dire. The service rules throw up the type of professionals you get. I mean, it's not an organization that even has lawyers on board. If the Indus Water Commission wants to do something legal, it has to write to the Ministry of Water and Power, who writes to the Attorney General, who appoints a lawyer. So you get a new lawyer every time. I believe on the Indian side, there are dozens of lawyers that work for them. And that's just one example. So, you know, I find it ironic that we talk about things, people talk about things like Kalabagh Dam, but never talk about raising the capacity of organizations and institutions. You know, get better people, get more people in IRSA, in the Indus Water Commission, and see what results they yield. But trying to get blood from these stones as they exist right now is going to be very difficult.
In fact, as an emergency measure, we sent the Attorney General to the World Bank. He didn't even get a hearing. And now we are back into the situation where you kind of don't even have a right.
I'm a lawyer, and I find it very difficult that two people who are fighting amongst themselves go to their bank for a dispute resolution. Who goes to a bank to get their disputes resolved? And what is the role of the bank in the dispute resolution in the Indus Treaty? I actually wrote a blog on this some days ago for the Jinnah Institute. I had a good look at the treaty. The bank has some obligations. A lot of them had to do with that transition period between 1960 and 70 when it was managing the Indus Basin Development Fund. But all those obligations are of the 20th century. They don't exist anymore. It has two small functions when it comes to the dispute resolution process. You can either have a dispute under the treaty resolved by a neutral expert or a court of arbitration. And if India and Pakistan can't agree on a neutral expert, the bank can suggest one. And as far as the court of arbitration is concerned, if India and Pakistan can't agree on the membership of the court of arbitration, the bank has a role in selecting its chairman. That's it. why would we go to the bank and ask it, ke ji aap hamare liye ye karein, wo karein? I think it betrays either a misunderstanding of the terms of the treaty, or maybe there are other politics at play. There is, you see, the treaty has been adjudicated now two times, for Baghliar and for Kishanganga. And I think understanding the ramifications of the two decisions and what's going on is important. In the Baghliar case, which was first in time, this was a matter that went to a neutral expert. The issue was whether or not these spillways on the dam constituted a violation of the treaty. Now I have to explain what a spillway is. Because when you build a dam, you pond a lot of water and it sediments and it silts. And so every now and then, for the health of the dam, you've got to flush it out. And you flush it out using these gates, drawdown sluices, spillways, what have you. And Pakistan objected to the spillways because what happens is when you let the water out and then you have to refill the dam, you are stopping water from flowing. So the refill process gives India that sort of upper hand where they can argue, where Pakistan argued that this was a violation of that obligation to let flow. So they said, yeah, design aap change kare. And the neutral expert, amongst other things, said of the spillway design that because of the nature of the site, because of the need of cleaning the dam and maintaining its life, because of the, you know, exigencies of climate change, this spillway design was probably the best and allowed it. And Pakistan felt that this part of the Baghliar decision was a catastrophic blow. Now, later on in the Kishanganga case, the issue of spillways came up again, but this time Kishanganga was decided by a court of arbitration. The difference between a neutral expert and a court of arbitration, there are nine people on the court of arbitration. The neutral expert's an engineer. He gives an engineering solution. The court of arbitration gives a legally binding decision. And the court of arbitration said of drawdown flushing, of these spillway-gated designs, that they probably do not comply with the treaty, that there are other ways of fixing a dam, and that a neutral expert's decision carries no precedent. It's only limited to the technical questions in front of it. Whereas our decisions are binding. So Kishanganga basically restricted the Baghliar effect and essentially said India can't have drawdown flushing. Now a new dispute has arisen on Ratli and the Kishanganga design, and Pakistan first in time went to the World Bank and said, hame court of arbitration bana kar dein. Utne mein Uri attack ho gaya, and Modi turned around and said, Pakistan did it. Blood and water can't flow. We'll cancel the treaty. And subsequently, India responded to Pakistan's request to a court of arbitration by saying, nahin, isko neutral expert ke paas bheje. Because a neutral expert is the only place they can expect a technical support for their proposition. This is the first time there's been a forum-related dispute in the treaty. Now, it's my opinion that Pakistan has a good legal stand. You know, the court of arbitration has said this about drawdown flushing. And Pakistan's first in time when it comes to the request to the bank to appoint a court of arbitration. But the bank recently, seems partisan, has suggested that Pakistan go to a neutral expert. Why? Why? Aap kaun?
So what is our recourse?
Humne unse poocha kyun? Hum seedha kehte hain ji, court of arbitration. We've got a better legal hand, upper legal hand.
Can't we go to the international court?
People disagree with me, by the way, on this point. And if I'm wrong, I'd love to hear it. If anyone's listening, you do let me know if you disagree on this.
But tell me, can't we go to the international court?
No, you can't go to a court unless both countries agree to go to a court. That's international law.
Options do we have?
Neutral, under the treaty, the neutral expert, or the court of arbitration.
So who decides?
Like I said, if the two parties can't decide on a neutral expert, the bank can appoint one. And if the parties can't decide as to the umpires in a court of arbitration, the bank has a limited role. And there's a technical process for appointing them. But Pakistan was first in time to request a court of arbitration. And Kishanganga decision of the court of arbitration, which is a binding precedent, says that they can do this.
Yeah.
So, bank ke paas kyun?
So we failed in it again. So, Rafi, I mean, the question is really, we fail again and again because we refuse to think, we refuse to pause, we refuse to debate, we refuse to build up a thinking infrastructure, we rush into things, we are always too late, we are always waking up after the
event. We must support the organizations that are doing this.
Agreed. Now, let me turn to the last subject that I deliberately left to the end, pricing water. how is it feasible? Is it possible? Mm-hmm. Can we start doing it? Do we have to live with the Abhiyanas? Can we rationalize this somehow?
I don't see why we can't. But first and very importantly, to price water, you need meters.
Mm-hmm. So what's wrong with that? That's not a difficult issue.
There's 10 millions of farmers in the Punjab. You'll have to meter their water somehow. Measuring.
That's not an expensive issue.
If you think that way, I tend to agree, because you can easily recount that. I mean, and even in our cities, mind you.
Yeah.
Even in our cities, like in Lahore, water pricing is ludicrous.
Yeah.
You pay nothing for water, which is why the rich get away with, you know, what's essentially murder.
I see people washing their cars in my
because there's no cap. I mean, there's no price on water. It caps out at a couple ₹1,000
yeah,
a month.
Yeah. It's absolutely ridiculous.
So you got to price water that's rational.
So tell me, what are the difficulties in pricing water? I know there could be some political vested interest. Forget that for a minute. Let's just talk about it. Hey, is it possible to begin pricing the water rationally? And how do we negotiate with vested interest to talk about the subject?
I think you'll find the issue of if you wanted to talk about vested interests and water pricing in Karachi, you'd be shot by the water mafia. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to talk about water pricing in the domestic sector in Faisalabad, you'll probably get a good patient hearing. They've got plenty of water.
And in Lahore.
And they have money. Lahore, you might find some. So different cities will have different sort of political
economies. It should be a local subject.
And it is a local subject. But I think pricing is a very rational thing to do. Mm-hmm. People don't understand that there are areas outside Gujranwala, Sialkot, where people still queue up for water at a public fountain or from a tanker. They are paying essentially for metered water. It's happening. Karachi mein toh a vast population does this on a regular basis.
Has been happening
so as a practice, this is happening. And so I refuse to believe that people will somehow be put out if water is priced. I think a lot of our bad habits will be exposed and people will bitch and moan about that for a bit. But then don't wash your cars in water. You know, I don't think it's a technical issue. I think it requires some political will and a bit of capital to pay for the meters at the beginning. But importantly, there has to be a good understanding of the value of water. When you price it, what's the value? You know, there are a lot of poor people in Pakistan. How do they use it? What sort of water use do we want to promote? Where should we allow water to go free? You know, if you price water, are you going to price water in mosques for the 5 times they use it a day? These are questions. So there has to be a discourse that's as important as the pricing as well, that values the sort of human right to water and the use of water by humans. Other cities have done this, and it's not difficult. You have a certain amount of water that's free, and then you price it increasingly as the usage goes up.
This discourse thing that you say, how can we start a discourse? How do we have a discourse on water in Pakistan?
Yeah.
Should it be led by the politicians? Should it be led by academics?
I find it very interesting. You know, this election, like the 2013, like the 2008, I found people when they were doing the canvassing the constituencies, almost to a man and woman, they talked about getting people clean water. I don't see how this is not a everyday issue. I find it one of the great disconnects in our discourse.
But I think the clean water issue is slightly different. I think the clean water issue that they're talking about is really something the World Bank or somebody talks about, DM, whatever, these MDGs and the SDGs, etc. I agree clean water should be provided to everybody, but I think they still think of clean water as a free good. I don't think we think of water as a resource that has to be conserved as well as used. Somehow we feel that we're living in the 18th century and water is abundant and we have to go back further
because here we are bound by the Hadith. I think it's remarkable that at the time in the Arabian world, the Prophet Muhammad said, drinking water is free. Because back in that day, if you owned the well, you owned everything. And to tell the guy who owned everything that this is, that's a huge big thing for Islam to do in Arabia. And people hold that to their heart. You know, there were some students of mine at LAMS when I used to teach law there that I did a essay on water in Islam. And thankfully, there's been some more research. And you can now, the hadith is now that you can charge O&M. You're allowed to charge O&M costs.
Who came up with that?
Wait, just bande ne pani ka ki facility lagai hai, usko he should get his fair deal back. That's the sort of
investment back.
Investment back. So we've even got in Islam the sort of structures available that can give you the pricing arguments, whether you want to add environmental costs to the price or any other type of, you know, recoveries you want to do. That's a question of politics. But we've got the support to price water at the domestic level, the technical ability, I'm sorry. We just need that political will. I think there's also a great fear for raising the price of water, and it comes from the agriculture sector. I think that's where the vested interests really lie. Drinking water is very, it's an urban issue. Abhiyana is a sort of rural issue, and there are different vote banks that respond to those. But I don't think the fear of one should be sort of transferred as a fear of the other.
But I think it might be technically or strategically better to start in the urban areas, and then maybe...
Because that's where the money is. That's where you can, you know, in the DHA, for instance, in all of the DHAs that I can, I certainly in Lahore, you can't wash your car. And if you do, tasveer leke, they'll charge you.
They'll charge you. Bilkul thi. So that can be done.
It can be done.
So this is fascinating. So what I gain is that, look, this is a very interesting, complex ecosystem. We really must begin to talk about it, research, think about it, start debating it, start understanding it, and our political processes as well as academic processes should start taking this very seriously. It should be a very serious subject that we should all start discussing. And maybe even with India, we should elevate our dialogue and start talking to them rather than just, you know, now muddling through. The era of muddling through is over. We have to be very strategic and professional about these things and talk about it. Lastly, you keep telling me, I've learned a lot about water from you, you keep telling me references about water. Can you give us some key books that people interested in this subject, let's say students, I keep thinking my audience, I hope my audience is students. Let's say some students want to do some research and write maybe a term paper, whatever they want to write on it. What are the key books, two or three books that you would recommend?
I think people jump into the subject because they want to understand Kalabagh Dam or the Indus Treaty. And there's some fantastic work by my friend Danish Mustafa at King's College. You can look for Danish. It's two A's.
Danish Mustafa.
Okay. King's College, London. He's done some fantastic work on the sort of political economy of water, including one for USIP on the subnational water conflicts in Pakistan. It's probably one of the best reference manuals you can can find on that. On the history of the Indus Basin, there's a fantastic book called Indus Basin and Social Change by Sayyid Zulfikar Bukhari, which is a great history of the infrastructure, irrigation infrastructure from prehistory, the Mughals, Ranjit Singh. Ranjit Singh got all the guns and the best military, but he didn't copy the British with the canals. It's strange, when he had that ability, that technical ability and that know-how, why he didn't put his province on an economic warpath as well. He could see that the British had done this in Bengal. Why didn't he take advantage? So there are all sorts of fascinating questions there. Undala Alam about the Indus Treaty is fascinating. She's written her PhD about it. But
can you get the thesis?
It's online, absolutely. Okay. Okay. She's also written several very accessible essays on the Indus Treaty. And the rationality of water wars. The thesis being that there have been so few nations don't hardly fight about water. Water conflict is subnational. So when we talk about water wars, the likelihood of two states going to war is very low because states are rational actors. But somehow or the other, that equation breaks down. It's fascinating stuff over there. There's some very good stuff by Iram Sattar, who's a graduate and now an academic, I believe, at Harvard. She's written about the IRSA and the Indus Water Accord, which is one of the most accessible documents about that. There's some fantastic research that Hisar Foundation has done. They have, in parallel to the national water policy, developed a citizens' water policy. So if you go to the Hisar Foundation website, you can find a document that talks about what, firstly, the provincial priorities of water, and then about what the federal priorities of water are. But it's not a technical document framed by a bunch of male hydrologists. So it's much different in its tenor and tone.
Okay, great. Any last thoughts?
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
I think this is wonderful. I think it's one of the best podcasts I've had. So thank you. And inshallah, we'll do this again.
Inshallah, so, absolutely.
All the best.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.